This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today, we are super honored to have with us an icon in the business, Mr. Jimmy Drew, the owner of James H. Drew Expositions. And we're really looking forward to hearing some great stories today. Thanks for coming, Mr. Drew.
Thank you.
So I was reading yesterday a little bit. I was looking up some old pictures and things of your show, and saw some front gates and some, you were doing things even back in the day. I mean, I guess your dad and that were really neat looking. I mean, front gates were a really cool thing back in the day. How'd the show get started? And tell us a little bit about your history.
Well, my father, Renz, Georgia, that's W-R-E-N-S, is 35 miles from Augusta. And Papa was working on the railroad, and he was on the Wadley Southern Railway. And then he moved to Renz, became a section gang foreman on the Savannah and Atlanta Railway, and they moved to Renz. He was making $23 a week with 9 kids. Ooh. And the breakfast was a nickel. And he used to give me a nickel when I'd stay with him. He'd give me a nickel every day. Papa was, my daddy was supposed to be hoeing in the garden, and that house is still there. I just went by it a couple weeks ago.
Really?
It's down on a back street. And he was supposed to be hoeing in the garden. And Cole Brothers Circus train came through town. And him and my Uncle Harvey, he looked at my Aunt Inez, and he said, I figured out I'm never going to have anything if I stay in Renz. So he jumped on the circus train, got him a job. And as long as Daddy was living, and even after he was gone, he died in 1984. But we had always had circus people come and visit the show because they remembered my father, you know, Hoxie Tucker and people like that, you know. But he said if he could be around the Cole Brothers Circus one more time, he'd work for free. He used to help unload and load the train. And it was the last circus. So in 1948, him and my mother got married in the 30s. In 1948, they bought a carousel with 20 wooden horses. That's the only ride we still have. And I've restored it maybe 2 or 3 times. And it's one of the most beautiful carousels. It's a 20 horse, 2 abreast. You don't see many of those, you know?
No. And what manufacturer was it? Who made it?
Alan Herschel.
It's a Herschel. Okay.
Yeah. He didn't have any money. He borrowed $10,000 from his sister, Inez, when I told you, live in Texas. Her husband was a typesetter for the Dallas Morning newspaper. And he borrowed that $10,000, put it down, and then he couldn't make his notes the first year because of rain. And he got to Princeton, West Virginia.
You froze up there for a second.
Payrolls that paid all of his notes, and he always talked about Princeton, West Virginia. Saved the Drew shows.
Your internet's freezing up a little bit, unfortunately.
Okay.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
There you go. So he started with the one carousel and played a couple like little festivals and things, and.
Well, we probably have played in West Virginia more than any place else, you know, all the way from Charleston, Charlestown, Nitro, Marmette. I mean, you know, we got 25-year plaques in some of those towns. And but then as the show grew, that was a small show. And then Indiana and West Virginia are the two states we've played the most. And we still do the Mountain Festival in Bluefield, West Virginia. State line runs through the property. They park in West Virginia, and we put the show in Virginia.
I'm actually familiar with Bluefield because there used to be a Texaco oil plant there. My father-in-law used to run it.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, he was in charge of the Norfolk plant in Bluefield, West Virginia.
One of the prettiest parts of the world.
It is a neat place. So by that time, he accumulated some rides and started to get a little bit of equipment under his belt?
He bought a new Ferris wheel from Eli Bridge Company, a new carousel from Alan Herschel. And then he had about three kiddie rides. That was a show, five rides. And then he built a show for James Brown. James Brown was a teenager back then from Augusta also. And James Brown was looking for work.
So the James Brown you're talking about.
I'm talking about the Augusta James Brown.
Wow.
I feel good, you know?
Right.
So anyway, he made the show when he built the show for James Brown. And most of those old minstrel shows back in those days were operated by preachers from Washington, D.C., and two of them that worked with my father was Professor Vidalia and Snow Mason. And they were the talkers on the show and the producers of the show. And he didn't get any money out of it, didn't want any money. He just wanted the show to be bigger. Well, it was a 100-foot show, and it made our little traveling show look twice as big, you know. And every time I would see James Brown right up until he died, if he saw me on the airplane, he'd move over to where I was sitting, and we would talk, and he'd tell me stories about my father. And it was a real smart guy. He elected Jimmy Carter president, and then he poked me in the chest. He says, "Jimmy, did you hear me? I didn't help elect him president. I elected him president." And he was the only one that could get the black vote for Jimmy Carter. He said, "Then what does he do? He don't return my phone calls. He never invites me to the White House."
Oh, no.
He said, "Then he insults me by sending a light-skinned black man to Africa to represent the United States of America." He said, "Jimmy, they don't want Muhammad Ali. They want James Brown. I am the top man in Africa."
Well, he's definitely confident, Mr. Brown, huh?
And I got a picture of that. You ought to have one of those pictures. I've got a picture of James Brown when he was a teenager singing. He was born in 1933, and this would be, I guess, the late 40s or something, you know.
And you maintained that relationship his whole life?
Oh, his whole life. I had a, wow. I came up with, you know, they say when you get ready to write music, if the idea is the whole thing, they say a good writer can write the song if you come up with an idea. Well, I had the idea for him, excuse me, but he died before I could tell it to him.
Oh no.
I want to take him to Nashville with some of my producers, country music people, put him in the Ryman Auditorium. And then he comes out and shuffles his feet. You know, he does that moonwalk. Mm-hmm. And he would come out and say, with this real sad look on his face, and he would say, "You know, my wife left me on the same day that my house burned down, and she took the dog." And he said, "I've had all bad." And then he shuffles his feet, and walks out on the stage and said, "I feel bad." That's, you know, his big hit was "I Feel Good," right?
Right, right.
So this was going to be a country music, "I Feel Bad." Yes. But I never did get around. Procrastination is a disease. And I never got around to giving that idea to him. He would have really made something out of it. I feel satisfied.
A country song.
Yeah.
So like most shows, I guess, back then you had a lot of carnivals? You had a lot of shows traveling with you, or just?
Well, they were. And let me tell you why it was that way. You know, we didn't have frequency drives and electronics and all of that stuff. And we had gasoline motors, farm motors is what they were. John Deere case motors, Caterpillar motors on the tilt-a-whirl. And we had small generator to run the lights. And so back then it was all shows and games and mm-hmm. food. That's just what we had. And the food was canvas. They had to carry everything. They didn't have trailers back in those days. I've got a picture of my father, who happened to be with Colonel Tom Parker on the L.J. Heth show in Alabama. Now, Colonel Tom told me that story himself. And I got a picture on one of my passbook covers, 1937, of Colonel Tom Parker and of the show, L.J. Heth shows in Alabama. And that, you know, then the reason they put four Ferris wheels in a lineup is because there wasn't any rides. You had a carousel, right. You had Ferris wheels, a swing, and maybe a Heyday or a...
Got to slow down again on you. We lost your, you're frozen, your internet is. Keep talking, Mr. Drew, if you are, because I can't hear you. Oh, there you are.
You're back now.
Yep, you're frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that you're talking about the show putting four Ferris wheels and.
They put four Ferris wheels because to make the number of the ride count be greater.
Right.
They weren't many rides back then, so they put four Ferris wheels together, and that was four rides, you know. And it was very interesting. My father and my mother were maybe about 10 years was with the F.E. Gooding Amusement Company in Ohio. Oh, okay. I know you heard about that.
Sure.
And that's when he decided to go out and buy a carousel. And then the Ferris wheel next. And he always talked about Alan Herschel and Eli Bridge, how good they were to him, because he didn't have any credit. And they let him pay for those rides over time. And that's how I got started.
And that's I was thinking about that because I've done a few shows on history and was talking about Conklin shows and things. And excuse me. The process of buying a ride, we take it for granted now because you go make a phone call or you go see him somewhere. How did you even do it? Did you do it through letter or billboard, or how would you do it back in the day? It must have been crazy.
Well, I've got a copy of the contract on my wall of my portable office of Alan Herschel when he paid $9,500 for that carousel with 20 wooden horses. Now each one of those wooden horses now is probably worth two or three times more than he paid for the whole machine.
Right. Right.
And they just signed the contract and they, did in the mail. It was mostly by your word. You did a lot of stuff by your word.
Then, absolutely. You know?
After my father passed away, I like to never got our route straightened out because he didn't have contracts for a lot of the fairs. They would just do it on their word. And my problem was figuring out what date that it was supposed to be, so they would all be sequenced in order, you know.
Right. Fit together.
Now, if you go look at the history of Bernard Thomas and Paddy Conklin, they look just like the Drew shows back then with the mm-hmm. same Eli Ferris wheels and those old carousels, you know.
That's the all way it was started. At first.
Say it again.
That's all there was at first. There was a Ferris wheel and a merry-go-round, maybe a whip, something like that, but that was about it.
I remember the shows having four Eli Ferris wheels in a row mm-hmm. with number five wheels, and then later with a number 16. And a 12 was very rare. A number 12 wheel was a little taller than a Eli number five, and that's the wheel that my father bought, was the number 12.
Oh, he did buy 12. Oh, that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then the ride heyday came later, I guess, around the 50s, 60s, stuff like that. There started to be some variety, a little more variety of rides and things
And then Lessie up in Philadelphia, they invented the bumper car, you know. And back then we had steel plates and they had to be moved by hand. And then we didn't know, I remember those days, we didn't have know what winches were, hydraulics and winches and all of that, you know. And boy, I remember one time I was in Elmer Valera's shop and he was showing me some of the pictures, the old pictures of the Valeras and things that they had built. You know, they invented the Seattle wheel. I don't know if you know that or not.
Space wheels too, right?
The space wheel. We got, you know, we have them both. You know that.
I do. I was going to touch on that a little bit. Yep,
yeah. Absolutely. But anyway, he looked at me with a sad look on his face. I was president of the Showman's League. I actually was president of Showman's League in the OABA in the same year, 1984, same year my father died. Nobody's ever been president of both of them in the same year.
Same time. That's great.
Same time. And so I was visiting all at the Ambassador Hotel that night. I was in his room and we were getting ready to go to the Ambassador Hotel for the West Coast Showman's Convention, you know. And he looked at this sad look in his face and he said, you know, he said, I hate it. He said, I'm 90 years old or 93, 94. He said, just when the technology is coming along to do some great things, he said, and I have to miss it.
Oh, no.
He had a great imagination. They were really great people. And both of those machines have been restored. We move this year, maybe the Seattle wheel, probably 10 times out of 20 shows. And we'll move the space wheel maybe once or twice.
Now they built that Seattle wheel when Patty Conklin was running the Seattle World's Fair, right? They built it for the Seattle World's
Fair. And they were two of those machines built. He built the first one for Seattle and it had a lot of problems and it didn't run but half the fair. The fair was 6 months long and it missed the first 3 months.
Oh wow.
So they took the Seattle wheel and sent it to Alan Herschel, because Alan Herschel was the best ride builder at the time, and they took it to Alan Herschel, and they made everything three or four times as heavy and built the one that we got.
So yours is the second one, technically.
We're the second one. Theirs was the one that was actually in Seattle, and I'll tell you a story about that. I had, who was it that owned the first one has had four or five owners of the machine. And I'm trying to think of who the owners were at the time, but they had a chance to sell that ride to the Philippines. So he called me up and said, look, he said, I can't sell it without the blueprints. He said, do you have blueprints? I said, yeah, I got the original blueprints. He said, do you mind making me a copy of the original blueprints? I said, sure. He said, how much do you want for the blueprints? I said, I don't want any money. I said, what I want, you have the seat, an extra seat, the 16 seats on a Seattle wheel. They have the 17th seat, and that's the seat that Elvis Presley sat in when it happened at the World's Fair. It was the name of the movie, It Happened at the World's Fair. And Elvis Presley and a little Hawaiian girl named Vicky Tu, T-I-U, I think it was. And I said, how about if you give me that seat and I'll give you those blueprints. And so he did. And I've got that seat and we display it out in front of the Seattle wheel when we put it up.
I've seen that before. That's really a neat feature. Absolutely. You know, when I see that Seattle wheel, you know what I think of? I think of Dr. Seuss. I feel like if Dr. Seuss made a Ferris wheel, that's what it would look like. I don't know why, it just tricks in my mind because of that unusual look and everything else. It looks neat.
Well, there was a doctor at NC State University. My old age is kicking in a little bit. It's nuts. But he wrote a book on Ferris wheels. And he told me, he's gone now. He's been dead for a few years. But he wrote the book on Ferris wheels, and he says, if he only had one picture of a Ferris wheel in his house, he was a Ferris wheel, I mean, a Ferris wheel fan, connoisseur, whatever you want to say. And he only had the Seattle wheel in his living room. That was the only one he had. And he told me, he said, if Michelangelo or Picasso had built a Ferris wheel, it would be the Seattle wheel. Huh. And here we are in 2024, getting ready to go to 25. And nobody has built any wheel that is more impressive. It's like space age, years before its time. And there's nothing like it. And, you know, nothing we like spent it. You could buy a traveling show for what we put in that wheel. And you could also say the same thing about the space wheel. They're perfectly restored. You know, that's one of the reasons we don't like to scratch them up. We don't move them too much because we don't want to scratch them.
So the space wheels, that was another Volare invention, at least the first.
Well, they didn't invent the ride. There's a guy that was on the Johnny J. Jones show who was a game operator, and his name last name was Courtney. They called him, his nickname was Blinky Courtney. And every night, my father was on the Johnny J. Jones show with a lot of other people, John Campion, people like that, you know.
Oh, wow.
Danny Dell was over there. Paul Olson was on that show. And they were based out of, you wouldn't believe it, they were based in Augusta, Georgia. And so,
I said Johnny Jones was based in Augusta, Georgia?
Based in Augusta, Georgia.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And some of his relatives still live around town. I run into him, you know, occasionally. But this Courtney, game operator, and that everybody thought he was crazy. He had a dream of putting two Ferris wheels on top of each other and rotating. And people said, well, you can't do that. And every night he would take his money and he would count his money, whatever he made. The next day he would go to the machine shop and have another little part made, put it together, and he built the first one.
Oops, you froze up again. Hold that thought. He built the first one is the last we heard. There you are. Wait, now, Mr. Drew, come back. There you are. So he built the first one.
He built he's sold the rights to his to the Valares, and they came up with the money, and they had the money to develop it. And the first one they built was a sky wheel with a huge oak base, and it wasn't trailer mounted. And it took 135 feet in front and about 80 feet in back to wrap those cables and pull it up with a winch truck. Wow. And the reason I know 80 feet and 135, because I'm the one that was a lot man on the Drew shows, and I had to lay it out at the Augusta Fair in the fall. And there was only one place on the grounds it would fit. And Jimmy Haynes, I don't know if you ever heard of him. Jimmy Haynes was a Skywheel foreman. Had a big oak base, and it was all aluminum. And and we had it on our show several times, you know. But it was a wonderful machine. Then that trailer mounted it. I forgot. I guess it was Alan Herschel, maybe, that trailer mounted it. And they had the old one that was not portable. And I saw the ride. I didn't ride it, but I saw the ride in the park in California. But these guys were quite engineers and innovative. Charlie Edens owned the one that came to Augusta. You remember Charlie Edens?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Charlie just died about 3 years ago. His son, I'll see him. We do that fair in Johnson City. He's from Elizabethan, which is about 11 miles up the road. And one of the sons will come over and see me every now and then. But
How many space wheels were built? Two?
That's it. Two 1958. Space wheels. Only one. And I hate to say this. Say it again.
Just one was built?
One. It was the one that the Royal American Show wound up with, and that was the only one. Never had another one. There were two Seattle wheels, but only one space wheel.
Oh, I didn't know. I thought there were two for some reason.
No, and then I think
the Van Hulls had it.
Well, where you get mixed up, there were two wheels, but they were joined together with a center axle.
Ah.
They were two wheels, but they were together, like I said, they were together. And I'm not saying anything about any other wheels because all the Sky Wheels were very well built. But this space wheel, we didn't know this till we bought it and restored it, but it was way heavier than any of the other machines. It was heavy and it was basically the same ride, except it was just built heavier, you know?
How do those rides do in a lineup with all the modern equipment you have now?
Seattle Wheel hold up with everything.
Really?
The Sky Wheels are maybe, if you're on a big fair, the Seattle Wheel will be right at the top one or two or three with the things today. I'm talking about new modern things, but it has more capacity. Like one of the machines that we have just came out of Holland. It's only got 16 seats, or not 16 seats, 8 seats. So you can't keep up with the capacity. But now the space wheel, if you put it, it'll be in the top 10, the space wheel, but not, it won't be up there at the first two or three, like a Seattle wheel.
Now, so you've got the two wheels and the carousel that you mentioned, but you also have the band organ that you restored and looks beautiful and you bring out.
I restored that band organ in 1994 and 95. It was off the road for 2 years. Mike Kittner in Carlisle, Pennsylvania was one of the most wonderful people I ever met in my life. Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He spent 2 years doing it. And Rosa Patton, she did all of the front. And when it's all 24 karat gold leaf on the front, it's a silver leaf on the front, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And this organ owns the largest number 165 Wurlitzer collection of music in the world.
Is that right?
There are not that many organs. Maybe I don't know if there's 50 organs that play 165 music or not. I'm not sure. But I got a call one day from the curator from the Library of Congress, and he wanted to know if I had any of the original music. I said, "You're talking about the old green paper that Wurlitzer did in the 1920s and the 30s? He said, "Yeah, that's what I said. I got about six of those." He said, would you send them to me? I said, "Sure." I knew who he was. He's a pretty famous guy himself, you know. And so I sent the rolls to him, and sure enough, he found one of those rolls that was extinct. It was the only one known to exist. Jeez. So I sent the roll. He took the roll, and they got Andrew Park, blind since birth, but he is the guy that can still arrange 165 roll music. And they had him put the original two songs, one and two, were missing on our roll. And they rearranged them and put them in number one and two. And they had to change the tempo because the organ rolls, the reason it gets so complicated is as the roll gets bigger, it travels a little faster. So you got to space the notes out a little more, you see. And when the note is smaller, it's turning slower. You have to speed it up, you know. But anyway, then they give me my roll for free, and then they because they got the original from me, they sent me my original back with my new roll, and then they distributed the other ones to different people that had 165 music. So now it's not extinct anymore, but we just got lucky. We just had one nobody had, you know.
That's really neat. How often do you put up the band organ?
Now, say it again.
How often do you put up the band organ?
What do you mean put up?
But how often do you display it at fairs?
Oh, no, display it. About the same time as Seattle, 9 or 10 times in the year. It's displayed right now for the last 3 or 4 fairs at the end. It's operating. We put it in a rounded top trailer. And the people that built the trailer is the people that build great food trailers. It's Century Industries in Sellersburg, Indiana. And they told me they couldn't build a rounded top trailer. And I said, you got to build me a rounded top trailer. He said, well, why's it got to be rounded top? I said, because it's an old German organ. It's actually an Allen, a Wurlitzer organ, but it was converted to German, from German music to Wurlitzer music. And I said, all those old German machines were rounded top. I said, so they thought about it a little bit. They said, well, we can do that. So they put it in a rounded top trailer, and we put the organ that needed to be in the middle of the trailer because it's not as big. Trailer's a 45-foot trailer, and we had the front over the neck where the tractor hooks up. That was about a 14-foot room where all the roll music is at. So we couldn't live with that, having the organ on the back end of the trailer, because it needed to be in the center. So we put 14 feet in the front for the music, and in the back we added 14 more feet, and we had to do something with it. So we made an office out of it.
I remember I saw it once. I can't remember. I think it was with one of the Vivonas or something. You were showing it to them, and it's a heck of a piece. I mean, it's just amazing.
It's beautiful, and it plays in tune. We just had it last year. Took it to Joe Hilferty in York, Pennsylvania, and he kept it for about 2 months, and he tuned it, and a couple of the notes weren't working properly, and he fixed it all, and it's in tune. And it's the only organ in the world also. It not only has every roll available, and that's only about half of the rolls that survived. I've got the catalog of the Wurlitzer music, and we own about half, and we still own more than anybody in the world. But the other ones either got burned up in a fire, nobody bought them, they didn't make any of that one because nobody bought them, or whatever. But we've got everyone that exists. And Matthew Caulfield from Rochester, New York. Matthew is the expert. I asked him one day, I said, Matthew, could you tell me who is the best roll expert in the world? I said, you was with the Library of Congress for, I think, 37 years. He said, well, let me think about that a minute, Jimmy. And he thought, and he thought. He said, that would be me. But he's not sure if it's me. But he's the guy. He's the guy. So I asked him, I said, could you work for me for as long as it takes? We only had about 40 rolls for the machine. And now we've got, 300 or so. I said, could you work with me to get this collection complete? He said, I could do that. And I said, you just send me a bill. I didn't ask him what it was going to cost. So he sent me a bill, and every time I get a bill from him was like $18.40 for glue, for paper clips, and for stuff where you put the labels on the rolls. I said, well, that ain't very much of a bill. He said, well, I get my full salary from the Library of Congress. He said, this is my hobby. He said, I just do this for fun.
You know? That's great. Well, that's a question for you is, you know, I think people don't realize, I mean, some people realize that are listening, but some don't, but the amount of money you spent restoring that organ, restoring the Seattle wheel, restoring the, you know, you're keeping your carousel with wood horses, which is unbelievable. And the space wheels, I mean, you probably could have bought another 2 or 3 carnivals on top of that. So what drives you? What motivates you? What do you love about that stuff that you invest so much?
Well, that you just said it. You love it. And I had one of our guys told me a couple of years ago, he said, you know, I got you figured out. I said, well, what have you figured out? He said, you do this for a hobby. You don't do it to make a living. I said, well, we have to make a living. I said, but you're right. I do it for a hobby. When you do a hobby, you love it, you know? So absolutely. Love is the key word. And And I don't know of anybody moving these big organs. Royal American was the last one. And I've had a hard time finding the right people but they're still around. And Joe Hilferty up in York, and I said, Joe, how long have you been doing this? He said, well, I've been restoring organs and tuning and doing all of this for over 50 years, he said, and I'm still learning.
but those rides, really.
You do it because you want it, and I did this. This organ was restored strictly because of my mother and father, because they absolutely loved it. And I was going to make sure that history didn't take it away from us, you know?
That's great. I think you knew Lou May in Greenville, North Carolina, owned a, when I was growing up, when I was in the business early, he owned a band organ or two, but he loved those. He used to put them out on the Midway and he would just sit there and listen to them. And he loved them too. And really was a big admirer of the stuff
It still today is a sound. You know, I told you about the space wheel, and still today, there's no machine that surpasses it in beauty and elegance. And I can say the same thing on the band organ. It makes a sound with like when it plays certain notes, it sounds like a little bit of a squeaking noise, but it's a flute, a different type of flute. But that organ with those trombones, it makes a sound that there's nothing like it.
There isn't.
We have the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra did a march down one of our Atlanta shows a few years ago. And the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra stopped to look at the organ, and I played Stars and Stripes Forever to the Atlanta Symphony. And they turned around when it was over and played it back to the organ. And one is as good as the other. It's just, it's that grand, you know?
It's an amazing piece of work. But things like the carousel with the wooden horses, I mean, that's you. I mean, there nobody really knows or cares. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, just what it is. You know, they don't know if it's a fiberglass horse or not or whatever else, just, you know, but that's mm-hmm. so important to you that you keep those horses intact and on the road and looking great. So
we don't bring it out as much as we used to. We got a 1960 Alan Herschel that plays just about every day, but mm-hmm. then we got a few, in some places we put them both up, you know.
But just knowing their wood is just, that's just unheard of. It's incredible.
The Alan Herschel Company, as you know, those people from up in there and the Philadelphia Toboggan, those people were masters, and they did it because they loved it. So, you know, when we get ready to go out the door, we're going to have the same thing that we had when we came in. And when we leave, we're going to have the same thing. So we might as well do good work while we're here.
That's wise words. That's very wise words. So the other thing, your route, a lot of your route, you play the western part, the hills of Virginia and North Carolina and different places out there. Was it Mark shows that used to play those before your dad, I guess, even? Or where'd you get a lot of that route from?
We got one Mark show fair, and our route is Hickory.
Hickory, right.
And when he retired, he sold that to Danny Dale. And then Danny Dale, and after Danny Dale retired, it went to Paul Theodore and Jerry Murphy and Straits. The three of them were partners, you know. And then we came along in Hickory after that. And my mother's first cousin just happened to be the manager of the Hickory Fair.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My mother's first. She was born in Kings Mountain. They met on the road. My daddy took off with the circus, Cole Brothers. My mother took off with another circus. Somewhere or another, they met, and it took, you know. My mother had a saying. I never heard it nowhere except the North Carolina Mountains. She'd say those kids, they dated for the longest time, but it just didn't take. Well, my mom and dad, it took.
That's great. Yeah, your route and the places you play, they remind me of something like Danny Dell's show and stuff like that. He had a pretty solid route, compact, played yeah. played the same dates year after year as you do. I mean, some of your events you've been playing, I was reading the other day, like 40 years, 30 years, 50 years. It was a long time for a lot of those.
Long time. We still got ones in the route that are 70, 75. But now, but I got to tell you, my father, one of the things that molded our route is he went to West Virginia because that's where the coal miners had a lot of money and they had their miners vacation pay. But Daddy always told me, he says, when you get in those mountains, he said, they pay 4th of July. They do their miners vacation pay. He said, then they're broke for a month. He said, you got to get out of the mountains. So my father went to Indiana. We've been in Terre Haute since 1952. We was in Valparaiso for 37 years. And we do the other big show. There's two big shows in Atlanta, Indianapolis is the Danville, the two counties right there in Indianapolis.
Right.
Marion County and Hendricks County. And we do the Hendricks County Fair. So then we turn around. We're there for a month. And we turn around and go right back south of the two bit fairs in Nashville. We do one of them. Then we go from there right back in the hills to the Appalachian Fair in Gray, where we've been since 1954.
Wow.
We go from there, we go down the mountain at Hickory, and then to the state fair in North Carolina, Asheville. There's two state fairs in North Carolina.
That's one of the new ones on your route, the state fair.
It's a new one. It's 35 years. Yeah, we started that fair, and we've been there 35 years. 35, maybe 37 years, you know.
Yeah, scary
but some
enough,
of the best fairs that we have are ones that we started.
Scary enough, I remember when that fair, the first year of that fair, was it Bill Edmondson? Was that his name?
You got his name right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I remember that. My brain is so filled with obscure trivia for some reason. I never know what's going to come out. He was a nice guy, though. I remember him being a super, super nice guy.
We got some of the nicest fair people in the world, but we're nice to them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You bring them. What a beautiful show you bring them with all the equipment you do. So, what are some of your favorite events to play? Where do you? I know you love all of them. You're going to tell me that, but
are you back with me?
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Which one's sort of the most special to you?
Well, it.
Or am I like asking you what your favorite child is?
Well, yeah, that'd be about the right answer. I like them all. We have our route is pretty good and pretty solid. We operate 20 different dates, and probably the one or the most sentimental is the one where we've been to the longest, like Terre Haute, you know. We've been in Bluefield, West Virginia since 1951.
Jeez.
And that's where I used to go to join my father when school was out. School was out, I'd go to Bluefield, and that's where I'd work the whole summer, you know.
So in your span of time in the industry, what's changed the most? Like what, you know, I know obviously the rides have gotten bigger and stuff like that, but what else about the business itself has really changed the most?
Well, the what's hands down would be the technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, used to be the bumper cars, you had those steel plates and it'd take 10 men to get on them to pick them up and slide them on the trailer, you know. And now it's all done with winches and electric, and it's the and now we got frequency drive, and we can do things. And can I go back to the band organ for 1 second?
Yeah, of course.
The band organ, I meant to tell you, and I got on another subject. When Jerry Lee Lewis plays that piano, and we watch him play, and he rakes his hand across those keys and goes from one thing to the other, some of my organ professionals like Matthew Caulfield and people like that, they said, that organ can play songs and notes that a human hand is impossible to play because they can't go from one side of the piano all the way to the other side, but the notes can do that.
They can't switch octaves so fast unless they got
right
fast.
They can jump from here and jump from there. And that's what's a little unique about that. And I just love the machine, but that's me. But there's a lot of people do. And the people that do love that machine, most of the time, there are some of the most influential people, like a governor or a commissioner or somebody like that. Those are the people that will really can get into it, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, go ahead.
No, it's just we were talking about the changes that you've seen in the business. We said technology is the biggest. You know, when I was reading the Conklin book that came out and interviewed that writer. And, you know, what I was struck by a lot was how things, yes, the what has changed, but a lot of the same things that happened back in the whatever, the 30s, the 20s, the 40s are still happening today with the industry as far as route and worrying where they're going and moving the show and getting help and being able to make it from year to year and dealing with manufacturers. I was kind of struck by how similar it is in a lot of ways, even though it's changed and things have changed, but there's a lot of the same problems, a lot of the same issues that face a carnival owner as they did back then. Just the way we deal with it's a little different.
Just the way we do it. And I'm blessed with my son. I used to know something about rides, or at least I thought I did. That was back in the 60s. And that's when all of the finest rides in the world were built in America. You know, you had Eli and Alan Herschel and Ehrle and Rubitz, all those factories. Mm-hmm. And
Selner,
all of those. And but now I don't know anything about rides, but my son knows as much about modern technology and European rides as anybody in the world. And he's probably picked every ride for the last 15 years. And we had five come in this summer. Can you believe that? And it just accidentally happened. We're lucky if we can have a new ride each year. And sometimes that is not possible, finance or anything else.
Sure.
But this year, because of the shipping and because of the COVID and because of things not getting on time, we had five new rides hit us at the same time in one year. You know, we had three from Turkey. We had one from Italy and one from Holland. So, you know, all at the same time. And my son, the problem with him, I can't, our pocketbook can't keep up with his mind. That's the problem.
But what are some of your favorite new rides that you've bought in the last couple of years? What do you
think? There's some just great. I'd rather than the new ride, I just tell you manufacturers. And I still love, you know, the old Walter Larson, and I still love the Alan Herschel. All American stuff is great, you know, rides. But the rides in Italy, the technical park is wonderful. You know, KMG, we have some great machines over there. The Turkish rides, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff. Now, you got to ask about Pacific rides. You have to ask my son, but we got a lot of good equipment.
Yeah. But things, you know, people buy, they see what works. Somebody buys it from the carnival industry. It does well. And then everybody else kind of jumps on, you know, when things are successful, the word spreads pretty quickly and people really go after it. I was you know, struck a little bit by, again, the Conklin book about how when he would buy a ride from Europe and he'd bring it to the C&E, everybody would go and see it, you know, kind of like the Florida State Fair is a little bit, you know, or has been over the last 10 years or 20 years. But everybody would see it. It would see what was doing well. And then, you know, they'd wind up buying the ride and trying to be successful with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, I've been to the C&E a few times and we all do the same thing, but Jim does the ride picking, and it's hard to beat him. I mean, he just, I asked him, I said, did you know about this? Or, you know, oh yeah, I said, I've been looking at that for several years. He just don't miss.
He knows it all.
And we do some rides that we'll put them up and leave them too as well, you know?
Yeah. You talk about your son and, you know, obviously your dad started the business at third generation now. Probably going into more and all so many of the carnivals that are multi-generational, you know, the success, if you look just from a business standpoint, I know you read the Wall Street Journal all the time, but the number of businesses that are passed down from generation to generation in the carnival business, the success rate has to be so much higher than it is in just a standard business. Is that because you grow up in the business, you're trained in it, you have a great knowledge of the industry and everything else, but it's remarkable how many businesses are passed down, multiple generations, not just one.
If you don't have a background in this business, I'm not saying that you can't be successful, but you're handicapped. It's harder to be successful. But if you grow up around it and we've seen everything done wrong as many times and some that we have done right, it's the way you learn, you know. So absolutely. You buy a ride that's not the right thing because you knew it was the right thing the first week, but then you pass it along and somebody else thinks it's great. They'll buy it. We buy something else. But there's a whole lot that you can learn. And I'm like the band organ guy. You know, we're still learning.
Absolutely. Yeah. To your point, I was talking, I buy a lot of advertising for events, and I was talking to some of the people from, you know, kind of higher up in Town Square Media that bought, of course, Name a few years back. And they were like, we had no idea how to run that thing. You know, they were like, we got this thing. We just, it's really hard to run the carnival business. And it's very true. When you were growing up, what shows did you really admire? You said you're on Gooding's Million Dollar Midways or Gooding's Floyd Gooding show.
No, Gooding Amusement Company.
Gooding Amusement, right. Gooding Amusement Company. What shows did you admire the most and why?
Well, the ones that I always liked in 1962, when I was 17 years old, my father sent me. We had two of the first Skywheels of the eight that they built. Red Woods had two. We had two, and other shows had the Wilson famous shows in Illinois had one. I can't remember who had the other three. But my father sent me with Paul Olson with the Olson Show, and I operated his route, about half of his route, and then I would jump off of the Olson Show and do, we had one of those Skywheels that when we had two of them, we had one at the Ohio State Fair with Gooding, and we had one at Canfield the same week, and they both closed Labor Day night. Back in those days, Ohio State Fair was 10 days, Canfield was 5 days, and they both mm-hmm. closed. And then we'd jump and play a couple of the Drew fairs, and that was all we did. Then we jumped back to the Olson Show, played Birmingham Montgomery. And I really admired those railroad carnivals. They were six railroad shows in 1962, and we have just witnessed the elimination of the last one, which would be Straits. But if I can name those two, yeah, I'll try. I don't know if I can name them, but we had the Olson Show and the Settlin' and Wilson Show.
Settlin' and Wilson, course, yeah.
Straits and the Royal American Show was four. And we had, in the East Coast.
What about World of Mirth? Did they travel by?
World of Mirth Show. And the sixth one was the out west, Lloyd Hilligoss owned it. The
Reuben and Cherry, or
no, Reuben and Cherry had was gone in 62.
Oh, they were gone by then.
Yeah, they were gone by then. Lloyd Hilligoss, there's a railroad show, the only one in the west. I'll think of it in a minute, but anyway, that was the five in the east and one in the west. That was all the railroad, and we always used to wonder, how long before they're all going to be gone? Well, we know the answer now, but it just happened, you know. But Straits, I love being around. I used to go help load the train. Jack Morgan was the train master on the Olson Show, and I used to go hang out. I was always a mechanical guy. We'd get the Skywheel. I'd go help them load the train, help them unload the train, you know. And I love those people, those old Pollock Whitey was a Ferris wheel foreman, sat on a Coca-Cola crate at the Kentucky State Fair and saw him. All these guys were about 60 years old. These three guys, they didn't believe in extra help. They said they'd just get in the way. And they took these Eli Wheel. They took one down a night before the fair closed. And I stood there with my watch and watched him set to take it down in 55 minutes and load it in the truck. No extra help. And the best crew of people I've ever seen in my life. But all those old railroad shows had great people. They carried their own machine shops with them. And it was just wonderful just to be around them.
And most, did everybody live on the train pretty much? Or
they back in those days they did.
That must have been a nice perk, though, to have a place to live.
And the only railroad circus, of course, was Ringling, you know. But they had I don't remember that, or I probably wasn't alive when the last railroad circus left. The last circus bigger than Ringling was the Cole Brothers Circus from 35 to 40.
Hmm.
That was the last one. My father said he'd work for free if he could just be around it one more time.
That's amazing. So, you know, we went over so many interesting things, but how do you look at the future of the industry? You think it's bright or is it dim, or do we have a good shot at making it a few more generations? How do you feel about the industry in general? Could you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Oh, I said, how do you feel about the industry in general? What's the future look like, do you think, from the wise words of Mr. Drew?
Well, I think it's totally different for sure. We're down from 500 shows to about 350 now. So I'm told with my OABA friends what you're finding is the larger shows, you got less of those, and you got less of the medium shows, and the smaller ones are cropping up. Maybe they'll turn into big ones, but mm-hmm. They start out doing school carnivals. They'll do shopping center shows. They'll do everything. But I don't think it's ever going to go away unless they can figure out how to ride a mechanical ride on the internet. And I don't think they're going to be able to do that. One of the things, you know, people, to be really good at something, you got to love it. Yeah. And one of the things that I grew up around, my father took me to the Sherman Hotel when I was about 10 years old. And I went every year after that until 1971, when we left, or 70, whatever it was, when we left the Sherman Hotel. So I grew up, I got a picture of me and Jack Kaplan and Bernard Thomas and those guys, Jack Ruback, the old Texas carnival man, all wearing their white Stetson hats, standing in the lobby of the hotel. And here I am about 11, 12 years old, standing there talking to them. That's kind of who I grew up around. My mother loved the business so good, a business that took her and my father out of poverty. She was changed her family Bible in Kings Mountain, where she was born, Kings Mountain in Gastonia, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. She changed her Bible to, when she was 16, they'd let her work in the mills, in the cotton mills. And they were in the Depression. By this time, they'd gotten married, living in Augusta with a hot dog stand, trying to make a living in the winter, in the Depression with no money. And so she went down to the King Mill, which is now closed. They're making government housing out of it. And she went to the King Mill, and she told me the line was about a half a mile or a quarter of a mile long, all the way down Broad Street. And she got in line, knew she's going to be in line about 2 days. She was in line for about an hour, and a guy came with a clipboard. Has anybody in here got mill experience? And my mother raised her hand. She said, yes, I worked in a cotton mill. What did you do? I can run a loom. He took her inside and hired her right there from the line. And she worked until it was time to go on the road, and she quit her job and went back on the road. And she said, we don't know where we would be if it wasn't for this great business. And in our dining room, when we were eating, I was looking at Carl Settlemyer's pictures hanging on the wall with straights and circus people. and all of that, all the people that they grew up around, they had all of their pictures. She loved this visit so good because it took them from nothing to something. And she never forgot this business.
Of course, she, that, I don't know if you planned it that way, but that is a terrific way to end our little show here because that's a great testimonial. I got chills.
Eggly Settlemyer was another one. She had Eggly Settlemyer, and it is a great way to end. But she loved this business so good till the moment she left this planet. And what a great, great person she was and a great mother.
And we're so glad you could come on and share some of these stories and things. I'm trying to get as many people, excuse me, that have that history and knowledge and try and share it with some other people. But always great to talk to you, Mr. Drew. I look forward to seeing you at some of the fair meetings, I hope.
It's and, my great privilege.
No, it's mine. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.